Well, comrades and fellow workers, one of the difficulties when we deal with the anarchist group is trying to find out which particular anarchist group it is, because Mr. Hines and his 57 varieties didn't have a look in. So it's sometimes quite difficult, and I hope I'm not attacking a specific brand of anarchism that my friend here doesn't have to share. I've got a hold of the Black Flag, which is their newspaper, of course, and I've had a go at it as much as I can to try and make sure I don't make those mistakes. If I make a mistake, I'm sure my opponent tonight will put me correct. Now, recently in Glasgow, we had a meeting called Why We Oppose the Anarchists, and of course, we had a variety of those anarchists turning up. Some who were in favour of democracy, some who were opposed. Some who were in favour of trade unionists, some who were opposed. Some in favour of syndicalists, some in favour of direct action, and so on and so on. And of course, one of the other brands that we had is that peculiar brand of Spanish history, where they always laud the Golden Age in Barcelona. And I rather imagine that may be the tack my opponent will take this evening, but time will tell. I do notice an article on that specific period of history, at least one, with constant references to it in the Black Flag. What I intend to do as a spokesman for the Socialist Party this evening is deal with it in basically three ways. What is a revolution? Because I think that's absolutely essential, that we all know what each other's talking about, and if there's any doubt about it, we can at least clear that one out of the way at the beginning. And secondly, why it is that the organisation I represent, the Socialist Party, is opposed to all those different groups that come under a sort of umbrella called anarchists. And thirdly, and more importantly, to the real point of the whole discussion this evening, I hope, that is, how can a real revolution be achieved? So to the first item, namely, what is a revolution, let us discount immediately all references to it in the popular press and the TV and so on. And every advertiser tells you it's a revolution in food, it's a revolution in shoes, it's a revolution in all sorts of ladies' underwear, and so on and so on. And every political pundit talks about South America, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, one president, and Thursday, Friday, Saturday, another one, and that's a revolution. People talk of Marxist revolutions, of the Chile Allende revolution, I suppose following that, because there's another change, the ITT revolution in Chile. In other words, any change at all is looked upon as a revolution. Now, I'm not going to use that in any way. I'm not going to use it in that sense at all. I'm not going to talk about punk revolution or a hippie revolution or a sexual revolution. What I'm going to talk about, as far as I'm concerned, what the term means in politics, is a basic transformation and the whole basis of society. And as such, we recognise certain basic changes. The breakup of old kinship society, chattel slavery, feudalism, and modern day capitalism. These were basic economic changes. In turn, of course, the whole political atmosphere and the whole political power structure changed along with it. So when the socialist talks about a revolution, it means something very specific. He or she means something very specific. We mean a change in the basic economic relationships in society. Very briefly, and I don't want to labour the point, but if anybody's got any doubts on it, we've got the figures here. Roughly, we could say in the modern world, with few exceptions, the world is divided into two classes. As far as the modern industrialised society is concerned, that is absolutely true. On the one hand, a very small handful of fortunate men and women who own all the factories and the land, all the means of communication and transport and commerce. And the vast majority of mankind, all the men and women who produce all the wealth of the world, but own very little of the means of producing and distributing wealth. As I say, if anyone doubts that, I can give you figures worldwide or recent figures, the Royal Commissions and Wealth and so on. Roughly, we can say that it splits up something less than 10% of the population own 90% of the whole world's wealth, all the natural resources and all the commercial and transport undertakings. In other words, socialists see the world today as a capitalist one, that is, divided between two groups, between two classes. Further, we see that the whole purpose of production in this modern society is not to satisfy need, but in order to sell on a world market. Further, we see that all the political superstructure that's based upon those economic relationships all over the world, whether in the so-called Free West or the Enslaved East, or this bloc or that bloc, or the North or the South, or however the political pundits like to put it, all over the world, from the North Pole to the South Pole, from Siberia to the Rockies, a worldwide system with our government institutions that represent the owning class. We see a state machine that represents the interests of the real owners of the world today. So it's against that background that we would ask you to consider, how can a real revolution be achieved? Now, the basis, the whole basis of the power of the owning class is in their ownership. The way that they protect that ownership is by their laws. There are no divine laws that says this river should belong to this man or woman to the exclusion of all others. There's no divine law that says this means of production and distribution should be owned. To find out how ownership came about is the job of a historian. It's the job of looking back and seeing how it came about. I don't intend to give a lecture on that. In the main, it came about with murder. It came about with trickery. It came about with straight theft in many instances, especially when you consider in this country the Enclosures Act, the Highland Clearances, and so on. Suffice to say, however, that this owning class, no matter how stupid they may be, no matter how ill-informed they may be politically, are very property conscious. And these institutions of government, whether in the so-called communist bloc or the so-called democratic bloc or the fascist bloc or whatever, the whole purpose of governments is to protect that class ownership. Any attempt to even endanger it is ruthlessly dealt with. And it's here, of course, that the socialist takes a complete departure from any group of anarchists. It may be that some anarchists will speak about a future society very like that that the socialists would speak of, about the abolition of property, about the abolition of classes, and so on. But some of them would. But even those who have that viewpoint, nevertheless, have got the viewpoint that the real enemy to the attainment of that is, of course, this state machine. And it's no accident that Black Flag, rather like a lot of anarchist organisations and a lot of left-wing organisations, one of whom I debated here, see the state as the bogeyman. And it's all about fights, either between the strikers in France, in this case, or some punk in Belfast at a concert, and the policeman is a guy with a heavy truncheon and is a noble anarchist or a noble freedom lover having a hell of a bad time over it. And all of their propaganda and all of their efforts are put towards trying to direct workers' energies towards seeing this bogeyman of the state. And none of the ones that I've read, and I may be unfortunate not have read very much of it, but in all of the anarchist stuff that I've read, they never anywhere put the emphasis on the real bogeyman and the real cause of the problems, namely the class ownership of the means of producing and distributing wealth. And because of that, we then take another step back from their position, because it is our view that not only do we have capitalism because of the historical growth of the means of production and methods of production, we also have a working class that support that viewpoint. It's not a case here of the world's working class, all these wonderful people who produce everything and distribute everything, having this terrible contract put upon them. On the contrary, in most developed capitalist countries, it's a case that they actively support it. In other words, the world's working class take the viewpoint that this set of social relationships, owners and non-owners, buyers and sellers, stolen from and thieves, is the only possible social arrangement. It's a popular misconception It always has been, it is, and it always will be. Now, of course, it's true that amongst that world's working class, because of the problems they've got to face, they look for all sorts of solutions. And the history of anarchism is that where it had greatest support, in the main, if you looked at it in Italy, France, and especially in Spain, it was usually in Russia, it was usually where there was a backward agrarian economy. Because basically, historically, the case for anarchism is the case of the peasant, the case of the small proprietor. The case for socialism, on the other hand, is the case for a working class, worldwide working class, who are dealing with the real modern industrial world. Now, the Socialist Party therefore stresses in all its efforts at trying to put forward the case for socialism, and you can search back through all the socialist standards, and it'd be a rather strange one in which you didn't see some reference, in some cases articles, on the importance of understanding. Because the socialists take the viewpoint that what's called for to bring this transformation is a revolution in the ideas, that people's perception of this buying and selling system has got to be changed. And I'll deal with that a little later on in the last part, how can we achieve this transformation. But suffice to say, if I looked at any of the three issues in the supplement that they have produced and various other pieces of anarchist literature, what you would find is a rather ambiguous viewpoint in regard to how you can achieve this, and having achieved it, what exactly it would be. Because we don't agree on that. Nor can I find specifically in this Black Flag, the actual group we're dealing with this evening, can I find anything really concrete about it. But what I can see is some rather strange attitudes. For instance, in an article entitled News from Barcelona, what they do is they have a look at an exhibition put on there on the 50th anniversary of the Spanish Civil War. And the commentator, of course, looks back on this as a wonderful period where we had this anarchist revolution. Well, not in a developed form, but at least in some sort of form. And there were rather strange ideas all through it, but one of them that struck me as particularly peculiar, and it might seem a small point, but I think it's very symptomatic, is their attitude towards humour. Here's one. It's talking about the exhibition, and it says, there are moments when this can be macabre. For example, at one stage, a CNT commando found an old, well-dressed German gentleman with spectacles in a house outside Barcelona. They were about to take him off to be shot. Naturally, what would you do if you see an old guy with a well-dressed, especially a German, taking him for a fascist boss? Before somebody recognised him, it turned out to be Max Netlin, I don't get the name here, the greatest historian of the anarchist movement. This is his comment. I imagine they had a good laugh about it afterwards. Well, it's a good job they recognised him, isn't it? Mind you, that might have been a good laugh as well. So, I mean, there's this attitude all through it, that, for instance, in the dispute with the railway workers in France, they talk about, we have to be more militant, we have to get more direct action, and they're, quote, as far as I can see approvingly, that what you should do in a question of a strike is break up property. One of them is that you should cut the railway lines, you should blow up signal boxes, and so on. I don't know how the anarchist would feel about that if he was hurtling in a train from Paris Nord, and the signal box put him in the same line as a one coming into Paris Nord. Whether he would think direct action was such a good thing there. But nevertheless, what you'll get here is a thing that occurs all the time on what is ambiguously called the left wing. That is the loser's wing, the people who will permanently be in opposition. What they say is, we'll shake a fist at orthodoxy. We'll throw our thunderbolts at authority. But it's all rather pathetic. It has never got them anywhere. I mean, in 1936, they were on the verge of this great revolution, which, of course, as we all know, they didn't achieve. Instead, a fascist dictatorship came about. And despite all the direct actionists that were in Spain, and according to this there was millions of them, during that time they didn't manage to knock off Generalissimo Franco. It's true they blew up bus shelters, killed tourists, and blew up beaches and Christ knows all what, but they never managed to get the man that presumably they would have looked upon as being a feather in their cap, naive romantics that they are. So we take our viewpoint here that the real issue that intelligent men and women of the working class should be addressing themselves to is not knocking over policemen's hats in Belfast or laughing about how they nearly shot an anarchist historian. But what we should be doing instead is say, why is it that members of the working class who produce all the wealth of the world live in terror, live in poverty, live in insecurity? Why is this that here in a technically advanced society, well beyond anybody who could have dreamt of in the last century, well beyond the members of the Communist Party and the anarchists and all the other funny initials that existed in Spain in 36 and so on, a world they could hardly imagine, a technical dream world, as it were, a world of communication, satellites and all the rest of it. And yet, you cannot solve a medieval problem almost, the one of war and poverty and famine. Now the reason the socialist would say is not because of bad crooked policemen or bad crooked politicians or people selling one another up pathways and all the rest of it, but instead the basic society, the fact that we have this thing called this institution, this relationship called private ownership. And that brings me to the most important bit, namely, how do we bring about a real revolution? How can we achieve it? It's all very well decrying the fact that people starve while food is destroyed. It's all very well talking about the horrors of a bomb become, but I mean, we can all just have a pint and mutter into it and say, what a terrible thing. But the socialists take the viewpoint that something can be done. We take the viewpoint that far from it just being a case of throwing a few marbles under policemen's police horses, who's, I was going to say policemen and who's there, at demonstrations, what you can do is a real practical thing. It's not getting you in the newspapers, of course, it's not getting you in the Committee of 100, it'll not get you in the Angry Brigade, it'll not get you up in a murder charge, or it'll not get you thousands of people sending you Christmas cards as you're incarcerated in a jail in Spain or South America and fight martyrdom and all the rest of it. What you could do instead is address yourself to this real world and the real power structure. The working class today not only produce and distribute all the wealth of the world, they also organise its production and distribution. It is members of the working class who wear all the uniforms, the privates and the generals. In the main, the armed forces are made up of the working class. Even the police force, they're not recruited from Eton and Harrow. They come for the Godbulls and Islington and so on. That men and women of the working class run this society from top to bottom. Now the socialists take the viewpoint that what's called for is a growth of socialist knowledge. We think there are two agencies working here about how that will lead to a real revolution. The first one, and the most important one, is how capitalism develops itself. Capitalism, as it develops, makes more and more untenable. Nobody can hold on to old ideas about people are starving because there's not enough to go around, but you can switch on the box. Not a question of 1904, the Socialist Party was formed, and a speaker standing at a street corner. Now, at a turn of a switch, they can see people starving, and they can see the Lord Mayor's banquet. They can see great technical advances and people living in substandard housing. Mind you, don't need a telly for that, you just need to look out the window. In other words, what's happening is experience of the working class have driven them to reject old solutions. Political parties have come into being and disappeared. Political movements have come into being and disappeared. Amongst them, a variety of anarchist movements. Now, we take a viewpoint that change, that changes in the method of production, more and more make it the case that the superstructure, the political ideology, no longer can contain it. That even the best brains of capitalism sit and ponder Frankenstein problems. Like, how can you possibly deal with this food mountain? This is a real problem. Many of these economists would probably pray for some terrible Holocaust to come about to get those food mountains down. And that's not just a whim. Apparently the cotton growers way back in the 30s in the USA seriously proposed introducing the boll weevil into the cotton fields to decimate the crops in order to keep up prices. Now, of course, in the Guardian this week, I see one of these experts telling us quite blithely that old idea, giving butter to the Salvation Army to hand out, is not a very good idea. They called it lunacy. It goes on here about the real effort, they say, the Minister of Agriculture, is burn it. Burn it. That's the best way to get rid of these surpluses. Burn it. Well, let's face it, pretty logical that. You're producing for a market. The market can't consume it, the people can't afford it. We'll just burn it. That way the market will be there and we can start producing again. Now, that is the insanity of it. It becomes more apparent even to orthodox people who think along orthodox lines, that this society is splitting asunder by its own contradictions. Now, the socialists say the only answer, the only way to bring about that transformation in the basis of society is by transforming the ideas of the people who support capitalism, the working class. I mean, it's all very well saying the capitalist class support it, but to hell with them. We're not going to ask them to organise to bring about a society that will do away with their wealth and privilege. Our remarks, our case, is only addressed to the working class. And to go back to that Spain, think of the difference of what was written there last year or this year, I'm not too sure, with what appears in this month's Socialist Standard, which puts out an article that appeared in the Socialist Standard in 1936, about the very thing that this triumphs on about how wonderful it all was. And it goes on, I'll just very briefly put a wee bit out of it. The agony of Spain is only a matter of concern for the capitalists of other nations if any of them have interest involved, or if there's any prospect of gain by fishing in troubled waters. To the rest, it is a matter of minor importance that thousands of Spanish workers are losing their lives just because landowners in the Catholic Church want to keep intact their privilege to rob the wealth producers of the products of their toil. Now, that was written at the time, 1937. It saw the conflict not as a battle between liberty and totalitarianism, but a battle between the old landowners, the church and other landowners, and the new burgeoning bourgeoisie. Now, it's taken, 50 years to the death of the dictator, but look at Spain now. Is it not one of the most developing industrial countries in Europe? You'll see the adverts for their cars and all the rest of it. Washing machines, Christ knows all what. They're right in the world market now. They've been taken out of the old medieval thing. Now, that was what was going on then, to benefit one section of the owners against another. Now, as it happened, the landowners and the church and so on, the finance group, won against the industrialists and retarded the development of industry in that country to such an extent it became the main industry was, I think probably still is, was tourism, a cheap holiday, a cheap bevy. But now Spain is into the world markets. Now Spain is facing the same problem as the rest of capitalism. But so far from being romantic, millions of workers died in that conflict. A bitter, bitter conflict. One of the first modern wars, in the sense of the guerrilla warfare and so on. Fighting in the streets with citizens in the front line. But rather than romanticise that, what we take the viewpoint is say learn from it. Learn from it that the only step forward is the step proposed there in that article in 1937. Yet, in the advanced countries, at any rate, the workers produce and distribute the wealth upon which all live. While the capitalists control the wealth, they use their position to live in idleness and so on, luxury. And he goes on to say, the only solution is for the world's working class to take back that means of production from them. So we propose, before my opponent starts, just to quickly go over where we differ from them. We say the cause of all working class problems today is the way society is organised. Production for profit with its class ownership is the cause of all modern social problems. The answer lies not in attacking an effect of it, its authoritarian fist. The answer lies in socialist knowledge of organising politically to take that machine off them, not for workers to go up with broken bottles and razors and chains in the streets of Glasgow against nuclear weapons, but instead to capture that state machine. Capitalism cannot last when the majority of the working class reject it. So the Socialist Party entered the political arena in 1904 saying socialism's a practical alternative. Now, of course, history has shown that we were far too optimistic, because here, after all, we're 1987, 80 odd years later. And in the sense that the ownership is even more entrenched in the hands of a smaller and smaller group, we have failed. But in the sense that our case and our analysis has proven correct, as opposed to the madmen of the left wing and the anarchists who tried to recruit workers for various bloodbaths, our case has been proved correct. It's the sane, logical one. And you ignore that sane, logical case at the peril of your very existence. The only answer is for men and women of the working class to organise politically and democratically to organise a new society.
I'd like to thank Dick Donnelly, the Socialist Party, for that.